cheek. His gaze lowered once more, and he ran his fingers through his hair. Anyway, I was bored one day, and found that he'd checked this dictionary out. No idea why, but I started reading it. He lifted one shoulder as he dropped his hand to the counter. Because why not? I blinked slowly. Then one day at the end of August, the house phone rang, and I decided to answer it. He continued. It was this person from the public library, and... I think you know the rest.
I did know the rest. But this couldn't be real.
Quiet hot guy from school that you never spoke to didn't turn out to be funny random guy who refused to return dictionaries. Things like this only happened in Hallmark movies, the kind that made Libby cry like she was an angry, unfed baby. They didn't happen in real life. But this was happening. I wasn't dreaming. Tyler was really standing in front of me, and he had the dictionary. Letting out a little laugh, I shook my head. I'm sorry. I'm just really caught off guard. I thought I was talking to...
To who?
He asked, head tilting to the other side. I don't know. But not you, I said, and then added, I don't mean that in a bad way, but we've never talked at school, and... Then it struck me. Did you know who I was?
Not at first, he admitted, a faint pink flush spreading along his cheeks. You actually never said your name until...
Until a month or so ago, I said, remembering that call. I sat back in the seat, my hands falling to my lap. He nodded.
Before that, you always introduced yourself as calling on behalf of the library.
His gaze flicked away.
Then you said your name, and I figured it had to be you. I doubted there were many other people named Moss.
When I looked up, he was staring at the dictionary, his dark brows pinched together, and that faint blush still staining his cheeks. It had been him this entire time. I could barely wrap my head around it. Libby was going to die. She was going to die and be reborn. Tyler's gaze flickered to mine.
You never asked my name.
I opened my mouth to deny that. But he was right. I hadn't. I just assumed the name the card was under was who I was talking to. His eyes held mine.
Are you disappointed?
My heart leapt into my throat, and the same second my stomach tumbled over itself. I wanted to turn that question over and over in my head, analyze what it could mean. I wanted to dash into Mrs. Singer's office and call Libby. Of course, I didn't have time for any of that. A flutter grew in my chest. I drew in a shallow breath. I'm not disappointed. A slow curl of his lips spread into a smile.
Really?
I nodded, thinking, who in the world would be disappointed? Part of me kept expecting someone to jump out from behind the stack of books with a camera. Wait. My stomach dropped. Is this a prank? His brows flew up.
No. No way.
A kernel of suspicion formed. Why now? Tyler knocked his hair back from his forehead, and the strands immediately fell back in place.
I wanted to say something earlier, but I...
The blush deepened, and he looked away again, coughing out a low laugh.
I just didn't have the nerve. When I figured out it was you, the girl who sat in the back of history class, I wanted to say something then, but...
Another low laugh.
Yeah, I didn't have the nerve.
Leaning forward, I placed my elbow on the desk and covered my mouth with my hand to hide the goofy grin I knew was forming. It took me a few seconds to say, But you do now?
Well, I kind of figured Zazie might have given me away earlier.
His gaze slid back to mine, and the intensity in those brown eyes snagged me.
You told me you said Jazzy, I said.
Yeah, I know. I kind of got nervous when you responded, he said with a shy smile. I just... yeah. I was nervous. I couldn't look away. The flutter in my chest increased until it felt like a hummingbird was searching for a way out. Several moments passed, and something happened in those moments. I could feel the warmth in my face ratcheting up by several degrees. He rested both hands on the counter. So, I think it's past time for me to return this to the library. He paused, eyes twinkling. Especially since you have been so patient. I laughed as I picked up the dictionary. I think the word you're looking for is impatient. Never that, he teased. Oh, one more thing. Tyler bent down, and a second later, he plopped down the only copy we had of the Encyclopedia of Animals. I almost forgot. A slow grin curled my lips. And it might take a really, really long time for me to get through this. Yeah, it's a really big book. So you're probably going to have to call me to remind me to return it, Tyler explained, his gaze locked on mine. And I think it's probably a good idea that I get on my own card for this one. Pressing my lips together, I nodded. I think that's also a good idea. And do you know what else I think is a good idea? Dropping his elbows on the counter, he leaned in. That I give you my cell, so you don't have to call the other number anymore. You know, when you're working. Or when you just want to talk. He drew in a deep breath while my heart started jumping like a happy kangaroo. Or if you'd like to grab something to eat. There was no stopping the smile racing across my face, spreading even wider when the pink in his cheeks increased. I will definitely use that number. Yeah? I mean, I figure I'm going to have to call you repeatedly to remind you to return the book, and I wouldn't want the home phone scaring you again. His lashes lowered. You will most definitely have to remind me. Drawing in a deep breath, I said, And I'll probably need it when we make plans to grab something to eat. Grinning, he briefly looked to the side and then back to me. Well, that would be just Zazzy.
The Unlikely Likelihood of Falling in Love by Jocelyn Davies. Read by Bonnie Turpin. Part 1, Introduction. There are 24 interconnected subway lines running underneath Manhattan. That's over 6,000 subway cars with an average ridership of almost 2 billion people per year. If you stop to think about it, that makes the chances of seeing the same person more than once 1 in over 30,000. And that's if you're working with a closed system. If you're working in an open system, the chances are even smaller. And the chances of falling in love at first sight with one of those people are even smaller than that. I know. I've done the math. That's what makes this story so weird. The morning began like any other Monday morning in May, just a month before the end of my junior year of high school. It was one of those days when things just kind of clicked. I didn't hit the snooze button on my alarm. My sister, Aviva, didn't take forever in the bathroom. How much mascara does one really need to wear in seventh grade? And my well-meaning parents, who are deluded enough to think they're pretty cool for parents, didn't attempt to engage me in time-consuming lines of questioning like, Did you download the new Weekend Warrior album? No one downloads albums anymore, Dad. And what did you do to your hair? I slept on it, okay? The line at Brooklyn Bagels wasn't too long. My bagel was crisp on the outside, doughy on the inside. The cream cheese was evenly and sparingly applied. No messy globs that get all over your face and hands. And my peach Snapple was cold and sweet. I glided down the stairs at the Newkirk Plaza subway station. No one was walking slowly in heels in front of me or eking out some last texts before going underground. Or trying to carry a stroller by themselves. My path was clear. My aim was true. The B train rolled into the station right as I swiped my Metro card. As the train barreled over the Manhattan Bridge, I took a sip of Snapple and watched the sun come up over the lower Manhattan skyline. I was going to be on time for school, and things were okay. And then, something happened that changed my life. Something that never would have happened if the constellation of minuscule events in my life hadn't aligned perfectly to deliver me to this exact moment. There I was, taking a perfect sip of iced tea as the perfect sun rose over my perfect city. A city I love, a city that, for once, had conspired to get me to school on time. And I was leaning against the door. I refused to sit on the subway ever since the incident with the old man who wasn't wearing any pants. Looking out the window toward the Statue of Liberty, experiencing the first glimmer of that end-of-school-year feeling, that spring lightness in the air like fresh laundry, I could feel the rumbling of the bridge rails under the train car, and then a train was passing across from us, going in the opposite direction toward Brooklyn. And I saw him. He was standing in the doorway, too, staring out the window in my direction, and when our trains passed, we locked eyes. He had warm, deep brown skin and a flop of curly brown hair, and was wearing a navy blue zip-up hoodie with a travel-size instrument case, violin, flute, piccolo, strapped to his back. He stood up straighter when he saw me and grinned. His whole face lit up. I didn't have to look at my reflection in the metal-framed subway ads, pro city girl life hack, to know mine had lit up as well. And there we were, a girl and a boy staring at each other through the windows of two train cars passing in the early morning light. The sun rose higher, a radiant ball of light over the buildings, casting the world, and specifically his face, in a gold-hued glow. And here is the sad thing about the subway, the one true sad thing. Just as suddenly as someone comes into your life, they are gone. The same constellation of minuscule events that aligned to bring me here are shifting, unraveling, pulling farther and farther away into the cosmos. And I'll probably never see him again. A month ago, if you'd asked me if I believe in love, specifically the kind that happens at first sight, I would have laughed. I would have told you I believe in facts and numbers. You can't substantiate that love exists by plugging some variables into an equation and calling it a day. Therefore, why should I believe in it? It's not like I could prove it had ever happened to me. And yet, somehow, inexplicably, I couldn't shake the feeling that it just had. I'm probably extra skeptical this year because I'm taking Mr. Graff's AP statistics class. That's actually his name. In a class of 15, I'm the only girl. You'd think things would be different in 2017, but then again, I read online that the White House wants to offer girls incentives not to pursue careers in STEM. So you do the math, pun intended. The reason, I guess, is that girls can't hack it and will just drop out eventually to make babies and souffles. I don't even know what a souffle is, and I have no desire to push a 7-pound human out of my lady parts until I have at least 2 degrees and am a pioneer in my field, thanks. On the morning in question, the perfect morning, Mr. Graff was standing up at the front of the room, telling us about the final project.
"This is your opportunity to show the world what budding statisticians you all are," he said.
Graff is the only person I know who gets as excited as I do about statistics.
"Okay," he chuckled. "Maybe not the world. Let's narrow that pool to just our class. As you'll soon find out when you embark on your projects, statistics is all about narrowing the pool of data. You've been working hard all year, and this is your chance to show me what you've got."
"I'll show you what I've got," Alex Coffey said under his breath, and everyone laughed.
"I don't care what you've got, Mr. Coffey, if it's not some excellent math skills."
Graff was passing around a stack of assignments.
"I'll need to see and approve your ideas by this Friday. You'll turn in your simulated data by next Wednesday. Then you'll have 3 weeks to gather research, hand in your real data, and write up your final projects. We'll have presentations at the end of the month.
Matt Bloom, who sits on my left, glanced my way and shot his hand up.
Can we work in pairs?
He asked, before Graf even called on him. The hand in the air was purely ornamental.
No pairs, Graf said. This is solo work.
He had finished handing out the assignments and was back at the front of the room.
Ideally, there will be some real-life application to your study. And keep in mind that this is worth 50% of your grade, so there's a lot on the line here. You're my AP students, and I know you can do it.
A cheer went up from the boys around me. It felt like a scene in a football movie, and Graf had just given us his best coach pep talk. Clear eyes, full hearts, math game strong.
I want to see some elegant projects, people.
My heartbeat quickened, because I knew exactly what my project would be. Part 2. Hypothesis. As Mr. Graf says, statistics is all about narrowing the pool of data. If I was going to study the likelihood of seeing my mystery boy again, I had to narrow down the variables. For instance, here is what I knew about the morning when we first locked eyes. 1. The place, the third subway car on the Manhattan-bound B train. 2. The time, a weekday morning, 7:37 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. 3. What I was doing, looking out the window on the south-facing side. Since the subway system is so huge, I had to look for patterns. For instance, when I take the train at random times, I never see the same people. When I take it during rush hour at the same time every day, the chances of seeing the same people increases. Take my morning commute. If I'm on time, there's this one couple I always see making out. I think they're a year older than me and go to my school, but if I'm running late, I don't see them. For my project, I had to assume Mystery Boy followed the same routine every day. If I recreated those perfect conditions, I would be more likely to see him. But throw in other variables, and I would be less likely. Hypothesis. Changing the variables of the morning when I first saw him will decrease my chances of seeing him again. Over the course of the week, I came up with simulated data to support this. On Friday, I handed the whole proposal in to Mr. Graf. Part 3. Research. Friday night, my family miraculously sat down for dinner together. It's pretty rare that we all end up around the table at the same time. My sister is on the middle school field hockey team, so she always has practice after school. Sometimes I get together with some of the guys from AP Stats to do homework or work through extra credit problems, or I go to my friend Camilla's house for dinner. My mom and dad are in creative fields and sometimes work weird hours. But that night, we were all home. Mom even made her famous pasta sauce, which was actually the Barefoot Contessa's famous pasta sauce. So, Mom said, laying bowls and plates out on the round dinner table that used to be my grandma's. My sister plopped into one of the wicker basket weave chairs. The chair scratched against the floor and groaned under Aviva's weight. Vive, Mom said, pronouncing it Vive like we all do. These chairs were a rare find on eBay. If you break one, I am selling you on eBay and using the money to pay for a custom-made new one. Mom, Vive said, that is a really specific threat. Well, Mom said, these are really specific chairs. They're vintage, Aviva. Pretty much everything in our apartment is something Mom scored on eBay or at Brooklyn Flea or through some design nut she knows from work. She's a prop stylist for a famous interior design blog and just styled their first coffee table book. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 5 weeks. I don't even think I could calculate the chances of that happening, You have to be really super talented, and also all the stars have to align. My mom is a boss. Mom adjusted a Shibori indigo placemat, and V very slowly and deliberately stood up and then sat down again in a way that was clearly for Mom's benefit. Mom raised her eyebrows. Dad came shambling in jeans and a flannel. He's a sound engineer for rock bands.
"What's cooking?" he said, and Viv and I groaned.
"What?" "You're such a nerd, Dad," Viv said.
"We're selling Viv on eBay," Mom said.
"Only if I break the chair."
"Sorry I asked."
Dad took a piece of bread and dipped it in olive oil. "I have a question," I said, interrupting the flow of family dinnertime banter. "How do you know if you're in love?" Dad dropped the bread in the olive oil.
"Why do you ask, Sam?"
No one in my family ever calls me Samara. It's always Sam or Smee or Shmoo. Don't ask. "Don't get weird, Dad," I responded. "I'm 16. "Are you in love?" Mom was making hard eyes at me. "It's for research," I said. "I'm working on my final statistics project."
"Math," Mom, Dad, and Viv all said, making one collective face of disgust.
"Thanks for the support, guys," I said.
"No, no, we care," said Dad.
"Speak for yourself," Viv muttered.
"Viv," Mom said. "What's the project?"
Dad was serving himself a heaping bowl of penne. Mom fluffed the salad with tongs, and Viv was texting under the table. I could really feel the love. "I may or may not have fallen in love at first sight with a boy on the B train. I'm doing my final project on the likelihood of seeing him again." That got their attention. Even Viv put down her phone. "A random boy?" Viv asked. "Or one you know?"
"Random," I said.
Viv snorted her disdain.
"What do you even know about this boy?" Dad said. "He could be a psychopath."
"Or a misogynist," added Mom. "Or his name could be Demetrius von Snufflemuffin." "He's a musician," I said, remembering the instrument case. "Also, he looks good in a blue hoodie."
"Well,"
Dad said, not doing a very good job at disguising his skepticism.
"That's romantic, I guess."
"Dad," said Viv, "don't say romantic."
"Okay, why don't you give me a list of approved words and phrases, and I'll just read from it like a script."
Viv brightened. "Really?" "No, Viv, seriously." Mom passed the salad bowl her way. "You can't write your father a script." Then she added under her breath, "No matter how much we might want to sometimes."
"I'm a human, not an automaton."
Dad pretended to look hurt.
"Besides, the concept of soulmates was invented by Hollywood for the sake of marketing romantic comedies."
Dad took a bite of pasta.
"The idea that you have to meet someone in an adorable way in order for it to be meaningful is nonsensical. Your mom and I aren't soulmates. Fate didn't bring us together after some over-the-top series of missed connections. We met at the bar at Webster Hall."
"Excuse me," Mom said. "Not soulmates."
"Dad,"
Viv pushed the pasta away. "No one wants to hear about you and Mom and your gross love story." I kind of did. Strictly for research purposes, of course. But it looked like I was starting to lose the room, so I kept my mouth shut. On Monday, I commenced data-gathering mode. I catapulted out of bed the minute my alarm went off. I timed my morning routine down to the second. The train rolled in at a leisurely pace right at 7:12, and I had never loved it more than I did at that moment. I stepped through the doors and speed-walked to the window I had been looking out the morning I first saw him. In case you're wondering, I was taking notes on my phone along the way so I could record them in my data log when I got to school. Time, conditions, outside factors. So far, everything was going smoothly. And then...
Babe, you're wearing that coconut lip stuff today.
The makeout couple was standing against my door. As usual, they were so engrossed in each other's mouths that they didn't even see me. Excuse me?
It tastes like vacation.
Hi. Can I... More gross smacking noises. Hello there! I was practically shouting. The makeout couple turned around and looked at me without saying anything. I'm doing a school project and need to stand by this window. Do you mind? The girl stared me down. It's possible this wasn't my finest idea.
What's the project? Asked the boy.
The train was rumbling along at this point, inching toward the bridge. It's kind of time-sensitive, I said. If you just let me... If you don't tell us, the girl said slowly, how are we supposed to know if we want to help you or not? I clenched my hands into fists at my sides. Then I sucked it up and told them. The girl gave me the side eye, but she nodded at the boy. Without a word, they stepped out of the way and let me have the window. Thank you, thank you, thank you! I shouted in their faces as they walked down the train car. I'll bring you bagels tomorrow!
I like everything, the boy shouted back.
There are pros and cons to seeing the same people on your morning commute. I took my place by the window as we journeyed from the darkness of the underground tunnel into the light. The sun was shining. I noted this in my phone. There was still a morning haze that hadn't burned off yet, giving everything a sort of dreamy quality. I noted this, too. The objective weather conditions, not the subjective dreaminess. We were cresting the hill when a train barreled toward us from the Manhattan side. My heartbeat quickened. Was I going to see him again? Could it be possible I really was in love at first sight? And was I so starved for affection that a strange boy smiled at me and I thought he was my soulmate? Was this because my family didn't like math? I was contemplating all this when I saw the boy who may or may not have been named Demetrius von Snufflemuffin for the second time. You know how they say that when you fall in love at first sight, the world kind of stops for a moment? Just as I was registering his dimples and then the fact that he was wearing the same blue hoodie, my subway car came to a screeching halt. So did his.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are being delayed due to a signal malfunction. We should be moving shortly.
Demetrius shook his head. I rolled my eyes. He shook his fist at the heavens. I pretended to weep. He mimed knocking his head against the subway door, then fell down and out of sight. Ew, I said out loud, thinking of the many hundreds of strains of germs that blanket the subway. Last year, the New York Times published a study, and they found traces of the bubonic plague on some subway poles. Imagine what's on the floor. The man standing next to me gave me a look. I gave him a look right back. You just can't take any nonsense on the subway. When I looked out the window again, Demetrius was standing, writing something in a giant spiral-bound notebook. He held it up, and I squinted to see what it said. Made you look. I laughed out loud, then clapped my hand over my mouth. Demetrius grinned. He started to write something else, but before I could see what it said, my train jolted into motion and we were hurtling forward again, leaving Demetrius and his train in our wake. I couldn't think about anything at school that day except Demetrius. After I entered my notes into my data log, of course. Here's what I knew about him so far. His hair was off the charts voluminous. He may or may not have owned only one hoodie or had a closet full of blue hoodies. He played an instrument perfectly sized to strap to your back for a long subway commute. None of this was relevant to my research. On second thought, I entered it into my data log anyway, just in case Mr. Graff wanted to know. The next morning, I got up early while it was still dark. I was out the door as the sky was just starting to glow. It was too early for the makeout couple. The man who gave me the dirty look yesterday wasn't there either. In fact, the train was kind of empty, except for a woman in scrubs who was clutching a coffee, her braids swept up in a high ponytail. It was quiet and kind of peaceful. I stood by the window and had a perfect view of the sun cresting over downtown Manhattan. The windows glittered with the sunrise. Not a bad way to start the day. I wondered, as I always do when I'm up early and see something beautiful I never get to see, if I should consider becoming a morning person. I didn't see Demetrius von Snufflemuffin, but I didn't expect to this morning, and that was the point. I decided to make the following day my late day, since I had free study first period, and this was technically research for a school project. I slept in a little, luxuriating among the pillows after all the hard research I'd been doing. I took my time getting ready, ate a bowl of cereal while reading an actual print newspaper. My parents are into being analog. And even wore boots with a heel so that I would walk slower. The train was packed with men and women on their way to work. I pushed my way to my usual window, but there was a man already leaning against it. And my bargaining potential was limited this morning, as there was literally nowhere else for him to go. So I stood directly in front of him, and when we went over the bridge, I stood on my tiptoes to see over his shoulder. A train rolled by on the opposite track, but it was the wrong direction for most commuters this time of day, and the window I was looking for was empty. In AP Stats, we each updated the class on our progress. Mr. Graff took notes and nodded along, asking questions and helping us fine-tune our data collection. I noted with satisfaction that I seemed to be ahead of a lot of the guys in my class. Take that, gender norms! When it was my turn to present, a hush fell over the room. The boys lost their minds when I told them I had seen Demetrius again.
I can't believe you didn't give him your number.
Matt had his head in his hands.
You could have held it up to the window.
I didn't think of that, I realized. But if my data is correct, I should see him again the next time I'm on time for school. Maybe even tomorrow.
That's tempting fate, Alex interjected.
It's not fate, it's math.
Wait, said Justin Wu. Why are we calling him Demetrius?
My last class of the day was studio art. Mom had made me sign up for it because she said I was too high-strung and doing something creative would help to soothe my overactive mind. Camilla is in the class, too. It gives us a chance to catch up while we smear paint on a canvas. Alex is right, she said, dipping her brush into a blob of hunter green paint. It's fate. It's not fate, I countered. It's math. Why do you think you keep seeing him? Why do you think both of your trains stopped at the exact same time? It's fate, I'm telling you. I'll tell you why I keep seeing him. He goes to school in Brooklyn. I go to school in Manhattan. School starts at pretty much the same time every day, no matter what school you go to. There are only a limited number of ways to cross between Brooklyn and Manhattan, and one of them is the Manhattan Bridge. See? The pool of variables keeps getting smaller and smaller. If you think about it, how could I not see him? Camilla eyed me. This isn't an SAT question. We're talking about people. There's room for human error. That number is meaningless because it exists in a bubble. Human error, Sam. Real life is way more complicated than math. I respectfully beg to differ. It was a carefully orchestrated series of perfectly timed events that brought us together in the first place. Or, she said, it was the universe. Agree to disagree. No one understands the purpose of mathematical integrity except for me. And Mr. Graff. Camilla just smiled and smoothed black around the edges of the canvas. She's actually amazing at studio art and will probably be a famous painter one day. I don't know why she puts up with me taking this class with her. So far, it's done nothing to soothe my overactive mind. Over the next few weeks, I immersed myself in my research. I got fancy. I noted when it rained, and the trains were slower than usual, and people's umbrellas made the floor slippery and treacherous. Or when I made the mistake of trying to open my Snapple while speed walking down the street and I had to go back to get napkins. Or when someone cut in front of me and I missed the 7:12 train by a fraction of a second and the conductor didn't wait. I noted when there was track work or the train had to reroute over the queue line. I calculated the odds of the same thing happening to him, this boy I didn't know, at a different subway station in a different borough. Somewhere on the other side of this impossibly big city. My research was stacking up. I had pages and pages in a Word document saved on the cloud, an Excel sheet full of numbers. But here's the thing. I hadn't seen him again. I didn't understand what was happening. I was doing everything right. My hypothesis was airtight. My math was on point. Maybe Camilla was right. Maybe there was too much room for human error. Maybe it was the universe telling me it wasn't meant to be. Maybe Demetrius von Snufflemuffin wasn't ever supposed to be mine. Maybe we would go on like this, trains passing each other in the early morning sun, not when it rained, I noted, and he would continue to be Demetrius von Snufflemuffin, mystery boy. This instrument playing, cute message writing, germ-resistant, navy blue hoodie-wearing dream boy of mine. But maybe it was for the best. If we did ever meet IRL, then he would become real, and all this perfect stuff I sort of knew about him would be all mixed up with imperfect stuff, the real stuff, the stuff no one wants to know, the stuff that would take him out of the early morning haze of my dreams and into the cold, hard daylight of reality. I distracted myself by collecting the rest of my data. I worked on my poster. I made my spreadsheet pretty. I included graphs and even made some hilarious jokes about Mr. Graff's name. And then, in the blink of an eye, I mean, it was 14 days, but who's counting? There was only 1 week left. The paper was due Friday. All my research had to be complete by then. 5 days to change the course of my life. Monday, I was perfectly on time. But it rained, and the 7:12 train arrived at 7:25. Tuesday, my train was rerouted. Wednesday, I ended up being late because Aviva decided to use Mom's curling iron and filled the bathroom with burnt hair smell. Thursday, I saw him one more time. We both pressed our hands to the glass. I was hoping for something. Anything. Some kind of meaningful connection. Come on, train. If there was ever a time for you to stall unexpectedly, this is it. But I had no such luck. The trains went by too fast, and we watched each other hurtle off into the distance. Goodbye, Demetrius, I thought. Friday, the project was due, and I was on time, and the train was on time, and everything lined up exactly right. But I didn't see him at all. Part 4. Analysis. That was it. The whole thing was over. I was walking down the hall to AP Stats, about to turn in a killer final project worth 50% of my grade. To be honest, I'd never felt so good about a school project before in my life. So why was I so bummed? It was a stupid question because I knew exactly why. I was hoping the numbers would prove that I could trust my weird feeling about this guy. That if I did my research and followed the trail of data, it would lead me to him, and we would meet, and I would know what it felt like to be in love. I would have my answer. Numbers don't lie, even when the heart does.
Congratulations!
Mr. Graff was once again the most excited person in the room.
You finished your first step in your future careers as mathematicians.
He was wearing a party hat.
Leave your final papers in a stack on my desk.
I dropped my paper in a stack with the others. It felt surreal. A month of my life, a month of dreaming and working and pinning my hopes on a person I didn't even know. And now it was just another wad of printer paper stapled and shuffled in with 14 others. It was a piece of me, a real piece. And it was gone. Next time a teacher asked for a topic with real-life applications, I was picking something with lower stakes. The boys in my class all wanted to know how my project had gone. They grilled me about the details. Did I see him again? Did we meet? Even Mr. Graff wanted to know. They asked for a sneak peek of the results. You'll just have to wait for my presentation on Monday, I replied, cool as a cucumber. Everyone seemed kind of disappointed. You don't know the half of it, I wanted to say. Over the weekend, it rained. Camilla came over to do DIY projects and watch romantic comedies on Netflix. DIY projects are another thing Mom says will calm my overactive mind. She isn't wrong. There's something soothing about repurposing old jeans into something new and useful. So we went to town on denim with scissors as we watched You've Got Mail. Viv was sitting in the comfy chair playing on her phone. She didn't look up, but I knew she was listening. You see? Camilla said, pointing at the TV while she tore a strip of old denim to shreds. They live in the same neighborhood and cross paths every day and it takes forever. But they do meet at the end of the movie. She started braiding the strips together. Everything connects eventually, she said wisely. She's been talking like that ever since she started watching Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson. It rained and rained and rained, and I didn't leave the apartment for 2 whole days. My new denim choker was a masterpiece. The sun came out for presentation day. I woke before the sun. I was leaving an extra hour to get to school in case anything went wrong. If I'd learned anything from taking obsessive notes about subway patterns this month, something inevitably would. Happily, my foresight paid off since my train decided to go over the queue line that day. On the bridge, I watched the sun come up over the downtown Manhattan skyline. And even I had to admit how pretty it was, and how lucky I was to be alive and to call this city my home. Blah, blah, blah. Turning in the project had felt like the end of something, but maybe this presentation was only the beginning. Maybe I'd get an A and go on to get a 5 on the AP exam and get into MIT and get a competitive academic scholarship, and this whole project really would be the beginning of my career as a statistician, as Mr. Graff would say, and that's when, as dawn was breaking over the horizon, it dawned on me that I'd left my poster at home. Stats was the first class of the day, and I was the first presenter. Everyone wanted to know how my project had turned out. They made me go first. I checked my phone. It was 6:45. That was why I left extra time. Maybe Camilla was right about human error after all. At Canal Street, I got off and crossed over to the Brooklyn-bound side of the track. It was packed, which meant a train hadn't come in a while, which meant something was wrong. My heart started to beat faster and my brain started to do that overactive thing it does, imagining the worst-case scenarios. I had all but convinced myself that the bridge had collapsed when a train pulled into the station. But it was an N train, and the conductor was saying something, and I could barely make out the words.
No Brooklyn-bound B or D train service. Take the N to Atlantic and switch there for the B, D, Q, R, 2, 3, 4, and 5 trains.
At that point, nothing, not even subway trouble, was going to stop me from getting that poster. If I couldn't meet Demetrius von Snuffelmuffin, I was sure as hell getting an A on this project. I squeezed on between two large men who didn't take their backpacks off to make room for me or anyone else. The doors closed, and I held my breath, and we headed back to Brooklyn. As we made our way across the bridge this time, the sun was bright, and the morning haze had dissolved into the air. Everything looked sharper and clearer. I couldn't help feeling stupid about what a big deal I'd made over this mystery boy. People passed each other all the time in New York. Lives intersected and then diverged and went on their way. Once in a blue moon, maybe, an encounter would leave a person's life changed. But most of the time, it didn't. And that was the beauty of New York. Everyone was living out their own stories. A backpack shoved into me as someone turned around, jolting me literally out of my thoughts. No, not a backpack. An instrument case.
Sorry, a voice said. I need to be by the window.
And then we both looked up, and our eyes met. It was him, my mystery boy. Demetrius von Snufflemuffin, right there in front of me in all his blue hoodie splendor. He smiled. I smiled. And suddenly, I got it. I got what all the fuss was about. I got why people took unlikely chances and believed in fate and hoped for things against all odds. I didn't need the numbers to prove me right. The feeling was the proof. Because I was looking at this boy, and all I could think was, this wasn't how it was supposed to happen. I'd planned everything out. I'd done the math. And the good old universe did what it wanted to do anyway. I guess the world is bigger than that. There were mysteries yet to be solved, and this was one of them. The day our stories finally led us to meet face to face was the day nothing at all went according to plan. The day we met was an anomaly. And he could have been a murderer, or only looked good in blue hoodies and nothing else, or his name really could have been Demetrius von Snufflemuffin. But he could also have been a really nice person who looked great in all the colors of the rainbow, and have been the kind of guy who isn't intimidated that I plan to win a Nobel Prize before I'm 30. They don't award them yet for mathematics, but they'll make an exception for me. I'd never know unless I stopped imagining what he was like and actually talked to him. This was my one chance. And I wanted to. I really wanted to. I opened my mouth to say the most clever thing I could think of. "Hi," I said. "So, how many blue hoodies do you own?" He laughed, and his entire face lit up. Okay, so it wasn't my finest moment, but we were talking, and that was a start. Part 5. Conclusion. Statistics has taught me a lot about life. But I guess the most important thing I've learned is that there's still room for error, and there's a chance things won't go the way you want them to, unless, of course, they do. His name, it turned out, was Dev. He took the train all the way home to Ditmas Park with me, even though it meant he would be late for school. And since I was going to be late too, thanks MTA, I FaceTimed Matt Bloom and gave the presentation of a lifetime from my living room. The entire class cheered when I swung the camera around so Dev could smile and wave, and I didn't even get any points deducted for presenting absentee because, I suspected, I was Mr. Graff's favorite. And also because I wrote this conclusion and handed it in later that day with my most recent findings. It turns out Dev lives in Manhattan, but goes to a specialized arts school in Brooklyn, which was why we passed each other on the train so often. He composes music and can play the scores to all the original classic Nintendo games. He owns 3 navy blue hoodies, but he also owns a gray one and a black one, as well as several other non-hoodie items of clothing in various colors. But for the entire month of May, He wore the blue ones. Know why? It was so I'd recognize him. So I guess in the end, that probably skewed my data. But like I said before, you can't plan for everything.
259 Million Miles by Cass Morgan. Read by Sullivan Jones. I pause outside the glass door and take a deep breath. You can do this, I tell myself. This isn't like school. No one's going to recognize you. Or if they do, they won't care. These people have bigger things to think about. I place my hand against the wall and take another breath. It's fine. Everything's going to be fine. I straighten my tie, then check that my shirt's still tucked in, trying to smooth the awkward wrinkles. I bought 4 different shirts for these interviews, and none of them fit me right. Either the sleeves are too short, or the collar is too tight, or the seams look funny. All I want is to get through this final round, because if all goes well, I'll never have to choose another outfit again. I'll never have to make any stupid choices again. I wave the temporary pass the security bot gave me over the sensor, and the door slides open. There's only one other applicant in the reception area, which seems like a good sign. I don't recognize her from any of the earlier rounds, and she doesn't actually look dressed for an interview. She's wearing a plaid shirt and black jeans, and is sitting with one of her studded boots tucked underneath her, clearly unconcerned about leaving a mark on the cream-colored couch. Actually, now that I think about it, maybe she's not an applicant. Maybe she's someone's friend, or sister. I always assume that the applicants are only children, for obvious reasons, but that's probably not the case. I check in with the cheerful receptionist bot at the front desk, then turn around and freeze, unsure where to go. The first cluster of armchairs is way too near the couch. It'd be creepy to sit that close to the girl. But the other cluster is too far away. It would seem like I'm purposefully avoiding her. I shift my weight from side to side. I have to make a decision. Just standing here like this is even weirder. Quickly, I lower myself into the farthest of the closer chairs, then pull out my tablet so the girl knows I'm not going to try to make conversation. She doesn't look up, and I let out a sigh of relief. It's fine. I'm fine. I unlock my tablet and make a half-hearted attempt to start my physics homework. If this thing works out, no one's going to ask me to hand in my assignments before I leave. But I know it's dangerous to think that way. They started with nearly 20,000 applicants. It's a much smaller pool now, but it's filled with the strongest candidates. This guy I met last time is 17 like me, but he's finishing up a PhD in engineering at MIT. There's a thick hardcover book open in the girl's lap. A library book, I realize, catching a glimpse of the plastic wrap on the front. Her eyes don't leave the page as she absently twirls her hair, bleached blonde with dark roots. Her focus makes me feel a little guilty, actually. And I'm just about to tackle my first problem set when a flash of movement startles me. Peering over the top of my tablet, I see the girl lower her face to the book and inhale deeply. Like you do with a freshly baked cake or your grandmother's pot roast. Not some moldy library book that's probably been in 100 strangers' bathrooms. You jealous? The girl says suddenly. I flinch, as though she's just poured ice water down my back instead of asking a simple, albeit strange, question. She's staring at me with one eyebrow raised, and I feel my throat close up. This has been happening a lot since the incident. It's like my body's way of saying, oh, hell no, we are not going through that again. After waiting an appropriate amount of time for an answer that's never coming, the girl tries again. This is one of my favorite smells in the world. Here, want to take a whiff? She shoves her book toward me. Startled, I lean all the way back in my seat. Wow, okay. I get that people think real books are old-fashioned, but it's not poisonous. She laughs, and I stiffen, bracing for the rush of warm, prickly shame that's become so familiar. But it doesn't come. The girl's laugh is playful, but not mocking, and I relax slightly. Sorry, I'm not going to let you peer pressure me into huffing library books, I say, surprising myself. Since the incident, I don't speak without running through the options first, weighing all the potential effects. And had I thought about it, I never would have said anything like this. Too many possibilities for negative outcomes. She could be offended, or feel awkward and uncomfortable. Then I'd have to sit here, watching her as she waits for her friend so she can jump out of her seat and whisper about what just happened. And then maybe tweet about it. But instead of furrowing her brow, or worse, taking out her phone and ignoring me completely, the girl smiles. "Huff library books?" she repeats. "I love that. I would totally huff books if I could. I saw you do it about 10 seconds ago. Right? Right." I inhale the sweet, sweet scent of aged paper, glue, and library dust. I didn't huff the book itself. That would be amazing, though. Imagine stories going straight into your brain. I pause to consider this. I'd rather be able to remove stories from my brain. Even now, with everything that's going on? She gestures around the reception area. Don't you want to remember as much as possible in case you're chosen? Like library books full of germs? She smiles. Among other things. A voice calls from behind us. Blythe Cohen? I glance over my shoulder to see the receptionist bot standing next to the door. It's a newer model, one that uses the right inflection to ask questions. To my surprise, the girl unfolds her legs and stands up. So she is a candidate, I realize, feeling foolish. I almost stutter an apology for misjudging her, but stop myself just in time. She doesn't know I'd written her off as a friend or a sibling, though sometimes I feel like the people around me can read my thoughts, like my awkwardness is written right across my face. It was certainly clear enough in the video. The girl picks a bag up off the floor and slings it over her shoulder. Good luck, she says with a smile. Yeah, thanks. You too. The girl walks toward the bot, which has glided from the desk to the door. Blythe, right this way, please. Blythe Cohen. Why does that name sound familiar? I do a search for it, and my eyes widen as they land on the results. Right. She's the girl who invented that pioneering technique for cleaning up oil spills when she was 12 years old. She was on all these talk shows and even got to meet the president. I guess in that light, her casual demeanor makes sense. She's pretty much guaranteed a spot on this thing if she wants it. But why would she want it? Why would a girl with the opportunity to make Earth a better place be willing to leave it all behind? I have to wait for another 10 minutes before the receptionist bot calls my name and leads me into the conference room. 10 people are already seated at the long table, although I only recognize a few of them. There's Lauren, the program director, Tessa, the psychologist who evaluated me, and Chung, the engineer who oversaw some of my tests, including the one where I had to put an engine together underwater. Philip, good to see you. Please, take a seat. Lauren smiles warmly and gestures toward one of the empty chairs. I nod and try to sit without doing anything too awkward. Thanks for joining us for the final round of evaluations, she says, glancing down at her tablet. I'm happy to be here. For the first time, I don't fight the tingle of excitement spreading through my body. This could really happen. In a few months, I could be leaving all this behind. I won't have to finish that useless history term paper. I don't have to make up excuses for why I'm not going to graduation or, my stomach twists, prom. Instead of spending the summer earning money for college and exchanging emails with a randomly assigned roommate who wants to bring his therapy iguana with him, I'll be preparing for the greatest adventure in history. As you know, Lauren continues, you've been monitored extensively throughout this process. We're not just interested in your scientific aptitude, though that's certainly an important element. A blonde woman leans forward in her chair. That device you designed for collecting water is very impressive, particularly since you had no time to prepare. I nod, Thank you. There's no reason to tell them that I've spent most of life learning how to survive in extreme situations. In the jungle after a plane crash, in an urban waste